You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Sheila Weller returns to the show this week. She's an historian of American popular culture and an author of many books, including Girls Like Us, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, Coralie Simon, and The Journey of a Generation, and The News Sorority, Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, Christina Annapour, and the ongoing, imperfect, complicated triumph of women in TV news. Sheila Weller's new book is Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Sheila Weller, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's great to be back on, Carrie. Thank you.
So you've been on a book tour talking about Carrie Fisher, and what are...
And virtual tour.
you're not going to bookstores yet. You're doing...
I'm doing an event in New York at the Jefferson Market Library tomorrow, but they're not going to... Listeners are not going to...
It'll have already happened by the time they hear
it. It already happened, yes. I am doing an L.A. event on December 9th in Pasadena.
Oh, that'll be good. So I'm wondering, have you heard from readers? What do people think about Carrie Fisher? Does she resonate with people?
Well, people love her. I've discovered everybody loves her. I mean, not everybody. I mean, she was sharp-tongued, so there's some people that don't. But high-barred feminism who would never take a drug in their lives, and Star Wars fans and everybody in between, they just adore her. You hear, "I love Carrie Fisher," from all corners of the people that you run into. I think it's her honesty, it's her humor, it's her honesty about herself. Through 8 books and the wonderful tour, long tour of Wishful Drinking, her one-woman show. And just the TV interview she's done where the moderators, the hosts have cracked up, she's just hilarious and self-deprecating in a way that people find not only humorous, but a lot of, especially midlife women, I think, find very relieving and affirming, that their own issues with weight, with crazy, with crazy families, with age, with depression, with issues that they were ashamed to bring up, they're now in the light, brought up in a very humorous, self-deprecating, but self-loving way by this person who is, as the term is, Hollywood royalty. So they feel affirmed by that. I think especially Wishful Drinking did that.
Did you ever interview her or meet her?
I did not. And, as I said at the end of the book, my bad. What a shame, my loss. On the other hand, I think I would have been a little intimidated by her. She's got a very sharp tongue, and either intimidated or I would walk away feeling, wow, she is completely unique, because people who interviewed her or people who just had interactions with her, whether, they were a person, tasked with giving her an award or a lower-level younger producer who wanted very badly to get her into a show that she didn't want to do, or a Star Wars fan who had bipolar disorder, or somebody who took her on a book tour, or somebody who literally ran into her on the street. I mean, there were people who were, not on her level of fame or celebrity or sophistication, who she took an interest in, and they would leave thinking, God, this is such a funny, brilliant person, and she was like a shrink to me. She started asking questions of me. So there was a special quality about her that resonated, and a lot of it came from her interest in other people and other things, but great interest in other people. That was real.
Well, you write about powerful and creative women, and you've been doing that for a long time. So what drew you to write about Carrie Fisher? I mean, if Carrie Fisher had not died young, and she was young because she's younger than both of us, do you think it would have been time to write a book about her?
That's a good question. And people do ask me why Carrie Fisher. I don't think I would have thought, first of all, I did it independently without the family. I mean, I connected with them. I did write to them, and they politely declined, and then I didn't want to keep pestering them. And I did a couple of follow-ups, and that was it. But she would be writing her own books. In fact, people said she said so much, why do you even have to write a book about her? But clearly, when a powerful, important, significant person dies, you see the significant writ large. she became a sort of badass, is the word, is the term that's used, even though it's a little bit of an eye roller, feminist hiding in plain sight, or hiding, or not even hiding, in plain sight. I think her sensibility affected Tina Fey, who had been a fan of Princess Leia from childhood, Amy Schumer, that school of female Hollywood blockbuster comedians. It was before the Me Too movement, but Hollywood was getting its own feminism when she was still alive. And she began talking very frankly about age-shaming, weight-shaming, feminism, you know, in Hollywood. And she was funny about it and tough about it. And Princess Leia also was a feminist heroine. And young girls saw the movie and saw what a tough, sharp, self-composed woman she was, braver than the guys in many ways. So when she died, at the moment she died, and of course Debbie dying right afterward made it Shakespearean or biblical, but when she died, her significance just ballooned out, and people wrote about it, tweeted about it. There was incredible grief and awe, and it just seemed her significance was obvious, and it was multifold, from the Hollywood childhood and the experience in different Hollywoods. I mean, the childhood she came out of was, you live in Beverly Hills too, that was sort of the end of the 50s, you know, Debbie and Eddie. And she was a little girl with flashbulbs popping in her face and paparazzi stalking on her lawn. Through all of the adventures of her life, all the different chapters of it, including her challenges of an inherited drug predisposition to addiction and bipolar disorder, through all of that, she was brave, funny, a loving friend, charismatic, frank about her troubles, and honest in a way that we need more and more today, if given the fact that we have an administration that has made a great virtue and a triumph out of dishonesty. So when she died, that was just beginning to happen. Princess Leia posters were held aloft by girls who hadn't even been alive when this first Star Wars came out. And it just seemed a very significant. Her significance was just there. Can we talk about you? Did you know her? You said you knew her.
Yes, I did.
Everybody knew. I've been interviewed people, including been interviewed by people in Eureka and Oklahoma and Alaska, thinking, this isn't a Carrie Fisher town to do a radio interview. And the radio guys get on the phone and say, oh, yeah, she was on our show. Well, she was everywhere.
I never interviewed her, but I knew her quite well before she was famous.
Right.
We went to school together. I went to Beverly Hills High School, and so did she. And we got to be very good friends, and we used to go to her house and watch movies. You know, this was before video and stuff. And her mother had a projection room. Her mother, Debbie Reynolds, of course, had a projection room. And so we could watch vintage Hollywood films, which I was always been a fan of. I remember us watching Imitation of Life together with Claudette Colbert. Claudette Colbert wasn't there, but she's in the movie. And we laughed because we thought it's a drama, but it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And Debbie Reynolds came in while we were watching, and I embarrassed Carrie by asking Debbie Reynolds to sign a book for me. But the thing that I remember most about Carrie Fisher, and I think that it's kind of interesting because it's one aspect of her incredible talent that people don't know about, is how we took a class together called Musical Comedy Workshop. And in the class,
at Beverly, right?
Right. And you had to perform every Friday. You had to perform a song from a musical comedy. And, you know, we were all eager to do that because we were drama kids at Beverly Hills High School. And so every week we got up and sang songs. But Carrie never was there on Friday. She was always absent on Friday. She was absent a lot, but she was never there to perform.
Oh, I wish I had talked to you. I say that to a lot of people. I wish I had talked to you.
So on the day of the final, when if you didn't perform, you would fail the class. She showed up. And we all thought, well, she must suck because, you know, why doesn't she want to perform? And she got up there and sang Cabaret. She came up with her music and handed it to the pianist, you know, and this woman that used to play the piano for us. And she just like nailed that, you know, and she like knew how to hold the microphone and the chord, you know, and she just sang the hell out of it and just like blew us all away. And we were like, oh, you know, she could really, really, really sing. And she had a powerful voice, like a professional Judy Garland kind
of. She had a great voice.
Yeah.
The kids at Beverly loved her.
I also remember one thing that Carrie did for me. I was a maniac for Marlon Brando. I was a huge Marlon Brando fan. And she got to go to the premiere of The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day she brought me the ticket stubs from the premiere.
Oh,
very
that was
sweet
nice.
Of her, yes.
Yeah.
So that was my... I didn't see her again for many years, but I did see her in Berkeley when she was doing Wishful Drinking. And
that was a challenging time for her.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But she, you know, she either beat her demons or couldn't quite, but was never dishonest about them. And you could see them playing out, and anybody who had a relative, a friend, or their own challenges could relate. And, you know, she destigmatized bipolar disorder and mental illness. She went on Diane Sawyer on December 2000 and said, "I am mentally ill, I can say that." That was one of the big things she did.
Well, did that hurt her career when she let people know that she was mentally ill?
It didn't. She was everybody adored her in Hollywood. I mean, Charlie Rose said, "Everybody loves you." She was a wonderful script doctor, which was not well known until after she died, but she was considered one of the best because of her wit. She could punch it, and because of her just knowledge of scripts and knowledge of, you know, the industry. And did it hurt her? Well, yes. I mean, there were times that she couldn't get out of bed, and she's written about them and talked about them. But she would, whenever there was a Star Wars revival, she would get in shape to do it. And what was quite notable about her and very admirable is she kept working through it all. As she said, "You have been given a challenging illness, and there's no other option but to meet those challenges." That's what she said about bipolar disorder toward the end of her life, when she really became not just an advocate but a friend and an advisor to young people with bipolar. And she did that. She got up and dusted herself off and wrote those books, did Wishful Drinking for years during the time she was getting ECT therapy and during some of her most painful moments. I mean, I've got that in the book. It was a very challenging time. When she started doing it at Berkeley and thereafter. So certainly there were things she couldn't do. Certainly there were days she couldn't get out of bed, and there was behavior that was antithetical to the work ethic. But she somehow was able to do an amazing amount of diverse work despite having this with her all the time. And it was with her all the time, even if it was kind of under wraps or taken care of.
Well, you mentioned that she inherited her addiction from her father, the singer Eddie Fisher. Her mother had very bad luck with men and with money. What about Carrie? How did she handle those two things?
Good question. She seemed to always have money. And in fact, my editor said, "Well, how'd she get her money? How'd she get her money if Debbie was always broke?" And she was always spending profusely, very generously, and overspending is also part of bipolar. But she would buy 25 dresses and give 24 of them away. She would have buying contests with her friends, often treating them to, you know, giving them money to go into stores with her and have a race who could buy the most, the fastest. That was a bit of a mystery of how she had the money during the times that her mother did not have money. After the first Star Wars, they went from a very small salary or percentage to a good-sized one. But there was a time toward the middle end of their lives that she was, that Debbie, I think, depended on Carrie for help financially. And, of course, at the beginning, you know, when she left school to do Irene with Debbie, she was helping her mother pull herself together and get her career back on track after the disastrous marriage to Harry Carl. And there was a lot of back and forth with support, with competition, and with help, financial help between mother and daughter.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Sheila Weller She's a historian of American popular culture and the author of many books, including Girls Like Us, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and The Journey of a Generation, and The News Sorority, Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, Christine Annapour, and the ongoing imperfect complicated triumph of women in TV news. Sheila Weller's new book is Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Sheila Weller, tell us a little bit about the men in Carrie Fisher's life.
Well, there weren't that many men, really. I mean, she had a boyfriend at Central, at the London School of Speech and Drama, named Simon Templeton. The longest relationship was Paul Simon. She counts 13 years. That seemed long to me. They were together for a number of years, got married, got divorced quickly, then stayed together again. And then she had a very happy relationship with Brian Lord, the power agent, who was very loving, and they had a daughter together, and then that was over. Remained good co-parents. I was kind of touched and charmed by this. Toward the end of her life, she would ask people to fix her up a lot. Someone gave her an award at the Humanist Hub, which is connected to Harvard. Its motto is "God with good without God." It's for atheists, agnostics, and humanists. She was given an award, and she asked the young woman on the phone, "Please put all the unmarried Harvard professors close to my age in the front row." So she would do that a lot. She wanted to. She wanted to find another husband. She said the same thing when she got an award in D.C. The first crack she made was, "Everybody's here for the husband." Like she wanted to be fixed up. So there was a part of her that definitely wanted another relationship, I think.
There was something in your book that I wondered if you had second thoughts about putting in there. You mentioned that she continued her relationship with Paul Simon off and on after their divorce, and that at some point she saw him after Paul Simon had met his current wife, and that might have been news to her when she read your book. Were you concerned about that?
That's a good question. Well, I don't know in what context she saw him. I hope it's not too defensive sounding to myself. She relied on him for might very easily not have been a physical thing at all. I mean, she relied on him for his stability, for his there-ness, for his knowledge of her, for his stability. And she relied on many people that way. She had an enormous number of friends who helped her, and she helped them. But somebody did tell me that, and it was something that the woman would put her name to. It was one of her editors. I don't think anybody who met Carrie or who knew about Carrie through her significant people, like somebody who would be married to Paul Simon, would be surprised about too much. And I do think that was probably an interaction that was much, much, much more about him just being there for her, and being a confidant, and being somebody whose there-ness just meant something to her, and their history together meant something to her, than anything else. I don't think it was a re-upping of a physical relationship.
Well,
did I think about it? I thought about a lot of things. That wasn't one of the main ones I thought about, but you have a good point. That's a good point.
Well, what are some of the things you did think about? There were times when you said, "Should I include this?"
And some things I didn't put in. When you have a drug...
Sheila Weller, tell us all the things you didn't put in.
Okay, yeah. When you take a lot of drugs, you can be unpleasant to people. There was this kind of a spoiled girl quality about her at the beginning. I think toward the end, I hope that there was a character arc that came through in the book, and you see her reckoning with so many things, and parenting her parents, and seeing the value in kindness, and being able to cry about the weight shaming. I hope you see a more evolved and a person whose humanity really comes out in full bloom toward the end, because I think that's what happened. But there was a spoiled girl quality about her at the beginning, and like many people, when she had, for example, overdoses, and I didn't put all of those in, and there were more than those, and people kind of bit their tongues and hinted at them or didn't want to tell me and were very protective of her or did tell me. So I didn't put all of those in, and I didn't put the examples of her maybe being not as nice as she should be because of drug taking. That can affect your behavior toward people. Also, what I was going to say is when somebody sees you very vulnerable, for example, passing out or overdosing, you don't want to, there's just a natural sense of, I don't want to be around this person because they know the worst of me. So there were people that helped her out in situations, and she wasn't that, there was a sense that the friendship sort of ended or cooled off after a while. And even though I put a couple of those in, you know, I bit my tongue a little bit. I tried to explain as much as I could why that happened. It was challenging to write about somebody that complex who went the distance in so many ways, including, with behavior and, you know, the results of a inherited propensity to drug and bipolar disorder, and be sympathetic. I felt sympathetic with her throughout, and I wanted to alternate those situations that could make her look not so great with situations where she was incredibly generous, incredibly funny, and incredibly vulnerable. So that's the way I kind of handled that.
So you were saying that you didn't have cooperation from her family. You didn't interview her daughter or her brother?
No. The daughter didn't want to be involved, and I think she will write her own book, and I think it will probably be wonderful. She's a very admirable young woman. Everyone thinks look what she went through, and she's a terrific actress, very well parented by her father. I had a correspondence with Todd Fisher, and at first he was very nice. At first he considered talking to me or even some kind of a collaboration. I mean, I was never going to really do a collaboration, but I certainly welcomed his input greatly. And then time passed, and by the time I wrote him again, he was already deep into his own book. So he, for that or any other reason, didn't want to talk to me. But I did have a pleasant first, with him.
And what about Paul Simon? Did you talk to him?
No, I didn't even try to talk to him for Girls Like Us. I mean, I knew that, or I did, and he was one of the relatively few people who didn't want to talk at all. I got a lot of people for that book. And I knew from Robert Hilburn, who did his biography, that his policy, and it's very admirable, was that the women can talk about him, but he wouldn't talk about them. And that was very, very gentlemanly of him. So there were people I didn't even try. I didn't try Harrison Ford. I didn't try Meryl Streep. The slightly more unknown people, like her acting coaches, 10 people from her London drama school where nobody had actually gone and asked questions of, people who knew her on book tours, people who were showrunners or colleagues, fellow actors on some of the less known movies like The Burbs and Drop Dead Fred and the play Agnes of God. I went to some unexpected places. Her resume was so enormous. There were many places you could go to. Family Guy, the comedy series that she was on. I went there. So I didn't go to the obvious people that I felt would either say no or probably say no or give me the kind of quotes that were kind of safe and expected and which they had given elsewhere.
Well, she was also kind of in with the Saturday Night Live crowd in the 70s.
Yes, I did get a lot of them, and I was happy about that. I got Judy Belushi, got Susan Forrestal. Carol Caldwell was a big source. She was Michael O'Donohue's girlfriend, and she was a very good friend of Carrie's. Rosie Schuster, a little bit of Marilyn Suzanne Miller. Who else? Ron Daniel was on the outskirts of that. He was part of the Blues Brothers. He was a producer. A bunch of people. I got Richard Dreyfuss, who knew her for many years, and they both had bipolar disorder, and they called it manic depression. That was the preferred term. But I did spend some time on the Saturday Night Live years. I remembered those years myself from being in New York during that time. And And they were significant for her because Paul Simon was very much a part of that. He was Lorne Michaels' best friend in an apartment next-door neighbor. So that was a very rich, rich time for her.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're talking tonight with Sheila Weller. She's a historian of American popular culture and the author of many books, including Girls Like Us, Carol King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and The Journey of a Generation, and The News Sorority, Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, Christine Annapour, and the ongoing imperfect complicated triumph of women in TV news. Sheila Weller's new book is Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. It seems also, Sheila Weller, that you did a lot of research into bipolar disorder.
I did. Thank you for noticing that. It's a complicated field. People in the field argue with one another. I wrote an opinion piece for USA Today about it, and the Bipolar Disorder Organization of the USA first put it on their website, I'm forgetting the exact name, and then they had to take it off because people were arguing about it. Then I put a little codicil on it. I put a caveat on it. You put it back on, and people still argued. You find different authorities say different things. Is bipolar 2 not as intense as bipolar 1? There's a big, difference of opinion on that. I had somebody who worked on the book as a, I don't want to say what role, but worked on the manuscript, had a relative who had bipolar disorder and was correcting things on the basis of his or her understanding of the situation. So I did learn a lot about it, but it's complicated. It's an ongoing thing, and it is something that you live with. Any condition you have that doesn't have a cure is something that you have to live with. It's imperfectly treated. You will have drugs, or a cocktail of drugs, as they call it, and it might stop working for you. It might give you it might flare up on you. It might work perfectly for one person, or very well for one person and not for you. Something that's very good may be taken off the market. So it's very challenging, and there are differences of opinion on all those things.
Well, can you say, I mean, bipolar 1, bipolar 2, manic depressive, schizophrenia, what is it? You know what I'm saying?
Schizophrenia is different. Bipolar 1 is... I've got my notes in front of me. Is what Carrie ended up being diagnosed with. There's more mania and depression with bipolar 2. There are more periods of hypomania, which is the kind of mania that people like. And by the way, people who have bipolar, including the eminent authority, Kay Redfield Jameson, will say things like, "I'm glad I have it. I wouldn't not have it." There are moments when the highs are so delicious and wonderful and creative, and it comports with creativity and intelligence. The hard thing about it is those periods of what's called hypomania or safe low-level mania are very, very creativity-inducing. Richard Dreyfuss gave me some beautiful quotes about how magnificent you feel, and Carrie gave quotes like that too, and Kay Redfield Jameson did. So there's a period of within the condition that is very conducive to getting a lot of work done, getting a lot of creative work done, and feeling terrific about yourself. Then there's a period that isn't like that. So bipolar 2 seems to be less intense, but I know from people who have that diagnosis, it can have its periods of depression that are just as bad as bipolar 1. And, it's different for all the various sufferers.
You mentioned, Sheila Weller, that Carrie Fisher was, a modern-day Ben Hecht, a script doctor. What scripts did she doctor?
The Wedding Singer, Lethal Weapon, the Whoopi Goldberg movie, Sister Act, Tinkerbell, oh, sorry, Hook by Steven Spielberg. She did wonderful lines of Tinkerbell and Peter Pan. That was kind of like her first script doctor role job. And when she did it, she threw her heart into it. I talked to one producer of The Wedding Singer who stayed with her. People always stayed at her house, or almost stayed at her house, stayed very close to her house. And he said she was supposed to come in and just do one character, and she ended up really going over the whole script. She would watch TV shows because they had the name of the character. She would really immerse herself in the job of just overseeing the script and making it much better. And her motto was to get a good script, make the women smarter and the love scenes better. That was kind of her little, her motto. But I think she did that.
And when she was acting, she rewrote her own dialogue in some of the films?
Yes, she did. In something called Drop Dead Fred, a fairly forgettable movie with Marsha Mason was in it. And I talked to Marsha and I talked to the director-producer, and they both laughed. He laughed and said, you know, she came in and said, I'm not saying this here. I'm going to rewrite it. And everything she wrote was much better than what we had. And Marsha said the same kind of thing. And often they were more than willing for her to do it. But sometimes she just came in and said, you know, I'm going to fix it on my own. So she just was very good with wordplay. And that shows very well in script doctoring.
Well, she was a very good actress, and I particularly loved her in Shampoo, which was her first film.
Yes.
She's hilarious in that movie. And maybe, and I don't want to, it might be heresy to say, I mean, she's not particularly great in Star Wars. But
she would say that. She would say about her acting, have you seen me act? You know, I mean, I think writing was something that was more important for her to do well and more gratifying for her to be admired for and acclaimed for.
Well, what do you think are the films that she really, you can really see what a fine actress she was?
When Harry Met Sally was one of the films that's a favorite of her fans that are not necessarily Star Wars fans. It's very Nora Ephron, and it's very kind of middle period Carrie. I mean, the early period was with her long hair, very thin, her time with Paul Simon with that little English accent where she was just absolutely adorable, and the Belle of the Ball of Manhattan. The middle period was the short hair, everybody's best friend. She made jokes that when she was in the supermarket, people would ask her where things were because they didn't recognize her as a celebrity. And then the later period was, unfortunately, she gained weight. I mean, it's unfortunate. Women feel it's unfortunate when they gain weight, whether it is or not. So I don't mean that in any derogatory way. But her face changed and her voice changed toward the end. I don't think you can look at Carrie Fisher at the end of her life or the last 8 years of her life and compare her to the young girl who was with Paul Simon. They're almost unrecognizable as the same person. When Harry Met Sally was kind of like the perfect New York love story of a time and place, and she was the wise, funny, but very compassionate best friend, very witty, but also sort of non-threatening, not the raving beauty, not the star of the movie, and that's kind of a role that she took on, you know, in her life. I mean, she definitely was a magnet to her friends, but there was something very reassuringly friend-like and wise advice-giving about her, and she kind of personified that in that movie.
Well, Sheila Weller, I think that Carrie Fisher really deserved this book, and I want to thank you for writing it.
Oh, thank you. Did you like it? I hope you did.
I did very much.
Good.
The book is called Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge, and the author, my guest, Sheila Weller. Thanks so much for spending some time talking to us.
Thank you, Gary. It was a pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.